My name is Ben Varrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Thank you for joining me on the penultimate episode on Blonde on Blonde. I have a tiny cold at the moment, so forgive some slightly nasal tones in my voiceover on this episode. Thought I'd mention it. Don't think of it as a man with a cold doing a ramble about Bob Dylan. Think of it as a homage to the classic New Morning. So we'll get to today's episode in just a second. First, let's say hello to some new Patreon subscribers. Thank you for getting involved with Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra. People like Eric Ward. Hello, PK. Hi, Kerry Schwartz. Hi, Tanner Maguire. Hi to Stuart Dix. Hello to Thomas Morgan. Hi, Donald McDonald. Hi, Gabriel. Hi to Richard Miller. Hello to Benjamin Gilbreth. Hi to Tommy Byrne. Hello to Max. Hi to Jack Lynch. And hi to Ryan Meehan as well. You can subscribe to Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra. It's over, well, I think it's 6 hours of podcasts on there now, including the latest episode, which was a chat with Charlie McCoy, who is a multi-instrumentalist that's played on a few Dylan albums, including, of course, Blonde on Blonde. He had a big hand in Blonde on Blonde. And funnily enough, we talk about in the interview about one of the songs we're speaking about on today's episode, where he had a big role to play on the harmonica. So that is available right now on the Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra show. It's the same price as a pint of beer in London per month, and the link is in the episode description. So let's get back to this incredible debut album. Here we have a look at two more songs from it, and we also look at the legacy of this record. Let's go back to 1966's Blonde on Blonde.
Oh, the ragman draws circles up and down the black. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know that he don't talk.
Blonde on Blonde is without doubt a classic, but is it Dylan's best? Or even, is it the best album ever? According to Acclaimed Music, it's the 9th most ranked album on the all-time album list that seem to appear almost every single year. In 1974, the writers of NME voted Blonde on Blonde the number 2 album of all time. It was ranked 2nd in the 1978 book of Critics' Choice Top 200 Albums and 3rd in its 1987 edition. In 2003, the album was ranked number 9 on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. It stayed there in 2012 in its revised list, and it dropped to number 38, curiously, in 2020, which is a pretty big drop for 8 years. How many classic albums could have come out in just 8 years? In 2004, two songs from the album also appeared in Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Just Like a Woman was at number 230, and Visions of Johanna was at number 404. The album itself was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1999, which is all well and good. But those lists tend to favour whatever is in fashion at that point, so they often become distorted. I mean, Blonde on Blonde is always in there, but it moves up and down a lot, depending on what trend is fitting it or what trend isn't fitting it. The album as a whole, though, certainly ticks a lot of boxes. I always feel with classic albums, their stats are enhanced if they do more than just tie together a collection of songs. This, for example, was one of the first double albums ever, an ambitious record that did things its way, not including its name or the artist's name on the cover, that strange out-of-focus shot for the artwork, the curious song titles, and the length of some of those songs. It wasn't an album in the mould of anything around it. On the record, we continue this lineage, if we can call it that. I don't think Blonde on Blonde is a sound that is copied a lot. Albums like Revolver from the Beatles led to What's the Story Morning Glory by Oasis. Is This It by the Strokes led to Up the Bracket by the Libertines. And The College Dropout by Kanye West led to, well, a lot of people copying that soul sampled style. Those albums all launched new scenes and sounds and styles, whereas Blonde on Blonde is almost so idiosyncratic it can't be copied. It's almost too strange to be copied or recreated. Sure, it's inspired many artists, but it's so special that it stands alone. Perhaps no one has ever managed to capture this elusive sound. Lord knows it took Dylan a while to get it, and even then he couldn't really recreate it. Not that he ever really tried. But as he famously said, this was the closest he got to the sound in his head. It's not an unheard of sound, of course. It's essentially a blues album at heart, but it updates and subverts that sound into something completely new. This is why, for me, this LP is so special. It edges ahead of the other two exhaustingly good records in Dylan's famous 60s trilogy because, whilst I love Highway 61 and Bringing It All Back Home, they feel like they are of this earth. Blonde on Blonde, for me, does not. There's some weird songs on here, like the opener, for example, but there's also some big pop songs and more than a couple of epics. It's all washed in that thin, wild Mercury sound, and because of this, it feels like a record you can't really describe. The others in the trio feel much more definable. Still brilliant and masterpieces, but more definable. The blend of New York hipster and Nashville band is an intoxicating mix that we probably won't ever get again, least of all from Dylan. For me, it has the perfect blend of big songs and something interesting to say. I Want You, One of Us Must Know, Just Like a Woman, Salad Lady of the Lowlands are all classics that more casual fans would know, while Stuck Inside a Mobile and Visions of Johanna take care of the album's more interesting side, keeping it commercial but intellectual. There's also Light and Shade. Leopardskin Pillbox Hat is a joy to listen to, but Pledging My Time is more serious. Rainy Day Women is a big loud scream, whilst Fourth Time Around is subtle and shy. The record has it all, and it does it so well. As far as it being Dylan's best, well, this is obviously very subjective. On paper, it is Blonde on Blonde for the reasons I've just stated. It ticks pretty much all the boxes. It's a revolutionary album with good songs, it has an identity, it has huge originality, and a subversion of the past. But pound for pound, song for song, it might just lose out to Blood on the Tracks for me. In terms of actual songs, I think the 75 LP is a better collection of tunes. But Blood of the Tracks is like the other two from that 60s trilogy. It's earthly. It's incredible, but quantifiable. Whereas Blonde on Blonde leaves you with a strange, almost supernatural feeling. So maybe Blood on the Tracks has the best songs, but Blonde on Blonde is a better album. I don't know. It changes weekly for me, almost daily. But if you had to come up with an equation for the best record of all time, Blonde on Blonde Deconstructed would be pretty perfect. I've said before on this podcast, sometimes an album is only as strong as its weakest parts. Blonde on Blonde is never weak, but side three is its least verbose. Forgetting the thumping glory of Most Likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine for a second, Temporary Like Achilles, Absolutely Sweet Marie, Fourth Time Around and obviously Five Believers don't demand the spotlight in the same way as side one's fascinating display or side two's pop or side four's majesty. But that's just the thing. This is a different side of the record, literally. We have that bluesy moan of Temporary Like Achilles, the pounding mini freakouts of Absolutely Sweet Marie, the bluesy riff intense Obviously Five Believers, and the waltzy acoustic number Fourth Time Around. This collection of good, yet not considered classic songs, might make Blonde on Blonde take the crown as Dylan's best. But how does it stack up against other classic albums? Well, it's almost impossible to compare, of course, but while Blonde on Blonde has its own unique sound, it might lose out to other records that have pushed the envelope. Sgt. Pepper's, Pet Sounds, and even the Velvet Underground and Nico all probably introduced more avant-garde, newer sounds into the world of pop music. Dylan's double LP refreshes a lot of ideas that have come before. And while, of course, those other records I mentioned lean on established genres and ideas, for me, they don't do it as much as Dylan does here. But music isn't all about pushing the envelope and revolutionising sound. Dylan has never really been about that. In fact, that's why he's unique at music's top table. He never really seems to worry about that experimentation. When the Beatles were making Sgt. Pepper's, he was making John Wesley Harding. While his contemporaries Lennon and Mitchell were exploring jazz and the avant-garde respectively, Dylan's concerns were elsewhere. So while he probably loses out in terms of experimentation, it's not like he never experimented here or there or during other moments of his career. But he never jumped in the deep end. But that shouldn't detract too much from the actual album, the actual music on display here. So while Blonde on Blonde has a sound like no other LP, it didn't disrupt music in the same way that Sgt. Pepper's did. But for me, that doesn't mean it's a lesser album. As far as the actual album's sound, that thin Wild Mercury sound rules the LP, although there are times when we move away from it.
When she said don't waste, your words are just lies, I cried she was dead. Hey, she worked on my face until breaking my eyes and saying what else you got left.
Fourth Time Around is probably the closest we get on this album to Dylan going back to the sound he once had before he went electric. It has a nice little acoustic riff that seems to spin endlessly, which is not a million miles away from the guitar parts on Just Like a Woman. It's a pretty standard song, unlike others on Blonde on Blonde, but in common with the LP's other cuts, we're being told the song's story by someone who is tired and reflective. The song, many times, has been called a response to the Beatles tune Norwegian Wood, which was written by Paul McCartney and John Lennon for the 1965 album Rubber Soul. When Dylan finished cutting Fourth Time Around, apparently Al Cooper turned to him and said it was too similar to the Beatles' cut. Cooper was worried the Beatles might sue. Dylan apparently said Norwegian Wood was his song to begin with, so a lawsuit was out of the question. Depending on how you look at it, the Dylan cut is either a playful homage or a satirical warning to Lennon for copying Dylan's style. That quote from Dylan and Cooper appears to suggest it's the latter, especially when we highlight the line, "I never asked for your crutch, now don't ask for mine." Which could be seen as Dylan sending a shot across the bows for Lennon, as in, "I write these tunes, not you, and don't forget it." This song is basically Dylan doing Lennon doing Dylan. Depending on who you believe, Dylan would do something similar in the next decade with Neil Young on the song Forever Young. According to Paul McCartney, Lennon started writing the Beatles song in the early months of 65, apparently in the Swiss Alps. Of the song, Lennon says, "I was very careful and paranoid because I didn't want my wife Cynthia to know there was really something going on outside the household, so I was trying to be sophisticated writing about an affair." The affair from the Beatles song is carried over to the Dylan cuts, but Bob adds another layer. In Norwegian Wood, we hear our narrator and a woman discussed. That's the main storyline. But with Bob, there is a third person mentioned. Our protagonist is still at odds with his lover. Bob sings, "When she said, don't waste your words, they're just lies. I cried she was deaf." And later singing, "She threw me outside, I stood in the dirt where everyone walked." But while we hear about a she, we also hear about a you in the song. The you is introduced in the third verse with the line, "out of that picture of you in your wheelchair." It's a slightly strange line that might make sense later. Before that though, Dylan kills off his lover in the penultimate verse's lines of, "she screamed till her face got so red, then she fell on the floor, and I covered up and then thought I'd go through her drawer." It sounds like our lover has killed over, metaphorically or physically. In the final verse, we half expect him to go to a secret or now not so secret lover, but Dylan doesn't do that. He sings, "and when I was through, I filled up my shoe and brought it to you. And you, you took me in, you loved me then, you never wasted time. And I never took much, I never asked for your crutch, now don't ask for mine." By the sounds of it, our protagonist has gone to the person mentioned earlier in the wheelchair indicated in that crutch line, but it's more than that. Perhaps Dylan, a little irked at Lennon for nicking his style, decided to kill off his character from Norwegian Wood, the she, ending that song's narrative, then he decides to give the Beatle a mini dressing down at the end. Lennon could easily be the person in the wheelchair, perhaps a comment on Lennon's perceived pilfering from Dylan. He's creatively disabled, if you will. He's saying, "I know you loved my sound, I know you loved me in the lines you loved me then, but don't steal from me, I never stole from you, I never asked for your crutch, now don't ask for mine."
And I covered her up and then thought I'd go look through her drawer. And when I was through, I filled up my shoe and brought it to you. Took me in, you loved me then, you never wasted time.
The next track, obviously Five Believers, sees a return to the pop side of things, albeit blues pop. Dylan delivers an up-tempo blues romp with a screeching guitar, some shaken percussion, and a proper harmonica riff. It's probably the most prominent riff on the entire LP, and it's played by Charlie McCoy. For once, Dylan relinquishes control of the harmonica, and McCoy delivers a great performance. Why did he give up his heart for this one? Well, as McCoy told me on an episode of Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra, that style wasn't in Bob's wheelhouse. While this is the LP's least popular song on Spotify, its sonics are brilliant and a lot of fun. And listening back to the song today, actually, strangely, it sounds quite contemporary. As we've already seen, this song comes from the final proper Blonde on Blonde sessions. And also, as we've seen, Robertson comes into his own in this session. He delivers some fine guitar on the track. The final session was such a rush that just before recording, Johnston from the control room shouts out the wrong song title before Dylan corrects him. They were going so fast, they couldn't even remember which song they were doing. Just before they launched into the take, McCoy says to the drummer, "Do you want to count this off?" To which Kenny replies, "Might as well." Johnston, with an eye on the clock, pipes up from the control room, "Everybody together on this one from the top and all the way through, because one take is all we need on this, man." And off they go, launching straight into the take. It wasn't quite done in one take. There was a false start and a breakdown. Johnston wanted McCoy to move closer to the mic for one of them, and for the other, there was a bum note played. It led to something that rarely happened in the Nashville sessions. And Dylan lost his patience. As the take fell apart, he grunted, "What the fuck?" before cutting himself off in order to not cause any offence. After everyone stops playing, he then says, annoyed, "This is an easy song. It's an easy song." Robertson then ran down the song for the other players and they were off again. Somewhat ironically, whilst the next take was a complete take, it wasn't perfect because Dylan had messed up a little. Some of the lines just weren't quite right. After the take, Bob announces, "I don't want to spend no time on this song, man." And they didn't. They got it on the next take. Originally, the track was called Black Dog Blues, and like we've seen elsewhere, Dylan borrows from Memphis Minnie's Me and My Chauffeur Blues, but predominantly from Sonny Boy Williamson's song, Good Morning Schoolgirl. In the Dylan cut, there's more nods to classic blues, with the lines like "early in the morning" and mentions of "mama," both lyrical staples of the blues. And of course, it won't surprise you to learn, the song discusses longing. It feels like we're hearing from the same person that told us the tales of Johanna, or the one fuming at Achilles. Except here, there's a little more fire in their belly. Dylan sings, "Please come home. Yes, I could make it without you, if I just didn't feel so all alone." This is pretty much how the whole song goes from here. As we've seen previously, there's also an allusion to depression in the lines, "I've got my black dog barking, black dog barking." The black dog is, of course, a common expression for depression, dating back quite some way. Winston Churchill famously talked about a black dog, and apparently Samuel Johnson talked openly about troubling thoughts, saying, "When I rise, my breakfast is solitary. The black dog waits to share it. From breakfast to dinner, he continues barking." It's also another very bluesy line that Dylan might have liked. Either way, our narrator is lost and depressed without his love. He can't make it without her. In keeping with the rest of the record, it gets a little odder in the latter verses, although by Dylan's standards in this era, it's actually pretty normal. He sings, 15 jugglers, 15 jugglers, 5 believers, 5 believers, all dressed like men. Tell your mama not to worry because, yes, they're just my friends. This mama reference is paired with the earlier verse that reads, "Your mama's working, your mama's moaning. She's crying, you know, she's trying, you know. Well, I tell you what she wants, but I just don't know." So it appears our narrator is tempting his lover to be with him, to come home with him. He needs her more than anyone else does. This song doesn't seem like one of Blonde on Blonde's great mysteries. The fact that Dylan himself half discards it in the studio, saying he doesn't want to waste any more time on it, suggests it was not the most full, thought-out, passionate works of his. Interestingly, though, he didn't play it live until 1995. He gave it its first outing at Palm Desert in California. It comes towards the end of the set, before the finale of Like a Rolling Stone and The Times They Are A-Changing. And he continued to play it throughout that year, very regularly. He picked it up once again for his run in 1996 and then played it once in 97 before it completely disappears from the set list for good. Why it captured his imagination for that quick, intense run, we might never know. Back in the studio and after this song, they rattled through Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat and I Want You as the Blonde on Blonde sessions sped to a close. But after the sessions, what was next? That's something we look at next time. That is it for this episode. As always, thank you for listening. As I mentioned before, the Charlie McCoy interview is live on the Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra feed on Patreon. The link is in the episode's description. So, for the final time, I will see you next week for our last look at Blonde on Blonde. Until then, take care of yourself and goodbye.
A Fueled by Coffee production.